Welcome to Gruesome, your horrific true crime podcast. I'm Connie, along with future dental hygienist, Meg.
Hey.
This is episode
32. I got in.
You got in. I was like trying to think of what to call you tonight. And I was like, the obvious boss bitch alert.
I've been working since 2019 to get into this dental hygiene program. And I found out today that I got in. So, yay.
I could cry. I'm so proud of you.
I did cry. Yeah.
I was standing in checkout line at Walmart and I showed it to my husband. I was like, look. He didn't cry, but I was
like,
emotional.
Did he cry?
He was probably like, God, that means their schedule is going to get so much worse to record.
It is. It for sure is. That's okay. So,
this is episode 32, Weird Herb, the I-70 Strangler. And it's weird for me because I want to say herb.
I know, herb.
Herby.
Herb. I practiced it several times while I was writing it. I was like, herb. Herb.
I don't know why I just channeled that one lady. Looks like a hot dog.
Makes me want a hot dog real bad. I can't do it. I'm sorry that everyone just listened to that.
I'm not even going to edit that out. That was.
Oh, damn. Okay, that's fine. I'll be embarrassed. I feel my face getting red right now.
I can see it. Patrons will be able to see it. All right. Tell me about it.
So did you know that Indiana has its very own Amityville Horror House?
I did not know that.
It's not the Amityville Horror House. It's called the Fox Hollow Farm. Ooh. And it is said to be haunted by the victims of the serial killer that lived there. So just FYI tonight, today, whenever you're listening, this case is not going to be appropriate if you have any kids lingering around. There is a lot of sexual violence, strangulation, murder, pretty graphic sexual details, ooh, that kind of good stuff. So
set this one out.
Yeah, put your headphones on if you have to. In Indianapolis, between 1980 and the early 90s, gay men that frequented downtown Indianapolis bars began to go missing. Some just vanished, but the nine that were found had been murdered. Their bodies were tossed along Interstate 70, the road that runs between Indianapolis and Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah, 70.
Weirdly, in 1991, the bodies stopped turning up, but men didn't stop going missing. And the police that were investigating it had no leads. Alan Broussard was reported missing in June of 1994. And Roger Allen Goodlett was also reported missing in July of 1994. But their families weren't getting the answers that they wanted from police because there's a lot of red tape with missing persons cases. Maybe they ran away, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So these families decided to hire a private detective. Virgil Vandegrift was a retired Marion County sheriff, and he had started his own private investigation firm in Indy. Alan's mother and Roger's mother both contacted him separately and days apart, asking him to help them find their missing sons. The retired sheriff threw himself into the investigation and started hanging out at the bars that the men frequented, learning whatever he could. He was putting up posters everywhere. But what he found was that this was not just two missing men. It was at least a dozen.
Oh my God.
Probably more. And he believed, based on the stories he was hearing, that there was a serial killer at work. And Vandegrift went to the police to tell them this. But in conservative Indiana, missing gay men, not at the top of their priority list.
Especially back then.
Mm-hmm. 90s, no way. He ran out of leads for almost a year until a man named Tony Harris, which is not his real name. It's just the name that he requests to go by in any interviews or cases. Anytime he talks about this case, he chooses to go by Tony Harris.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I probably would too.
Yeah. He came to Virgil with a horrifying experience. He had been a friend of Roger Goodlett, one of the men that Vandegrift had been tasked with finding. Tony had recently had an encounter with a man named Brian Smart, and this incident had caused him to believe that this was the man that had abducted and murdered Roger. Tony was a regular at the gay bars in Indianapolis, but on one particular evening, he saw a man staring at the missing person poster for Roger Goodlett. He was silently licking his lips, eyeing Roger's photo.
Ah.
Uncomfortable.
Like that. Ugh.
That image, right?
Gross.
Tony's stomach dropped. He immediately got the sense that he needed to talk to this person. This guy knew something about Roger's disappearance. And Tony, he approached him, but he approached him very aggressively. He kind of like pushed on him, asking him if he knew the man, being a lot more touchy-feely because he wanted to see if he could physically take this guy, essentially. And the guy backed down. He was pretty, like, meek about it. He told Tony that he didn't recognize him, and he seemed to show concern as Tony talked about Roger, but it was ingenuine. It didn't seem like he was really concerned, more like he was pretending. Mm-hmm. And as Tony and the man continued to talk, he gave him the name Brian Smart. They talked all night. And as everything around them started to wind down, Brian asked Tony to come back to the house that he was currently getting ready for people who had bought it. They could drive separately and they would go swimming in the indoor pool at the house, have a cocktail. But all these men are going missing. All of Tony's friends are going missing. And he was concerned that if he vanished, no one would know that he was gone. He wanted to make sure his car was visible so people would come looking for him. And he suggested that he ride with Brian instead. And I would imagine that he was probably getting pretty sketch vibes from this guy to consider, you know, that he's dangerous in general.
Yeah.
But it's kind of badass to still be like, I don't trust you. I think you're dangerous, but I want to know what's happening to my friends.
It's so very movie-esque.
It is. That's what I thought too. And maybe that's what he was thinking also. He was like, I'm going to be the hero, you know.
I'm going to crack this case wide open.
Yeah. Brian was kind of weird about the request, but he relented and he allowed Tony to ride with him. They got into his car and headed north on US 31. Tony kept trying to make small talk with him, but Brian was pretty tight-lipped. They eventually pulled off 31 onto a back road that was lined with farms on either side. They eventually hit a long, winding driveway with a sign in the front that read Fox Hollow Farm. Tony only caught the word farm on the sign because it was really dark and they had been drinking and it was late.
Mm-hmm.
Tony described the house as a mansion. There were dogs roaming the property. There were cars there. Brian was very specific. Don't pet the dogs. He also told Tony that the electric was off in the house, but it worked in the basement. The pool was in the basement. Tony carried on. He followed Brian through a garage side door and into the basement. Lo and behold, there was a very nice indoor pool.
Oh, okay. I was...
I know.
I was like, there's no pool.
There's no pool. Don't do it, Tony. Unsettlingly, around the pool were precariously placed mannequins, all in different positions, as though they were attending some kind of pool party. Tony looked at them, kind of confused.
And yeah, like, what the hell?
Brian only remarked, the owner doesn't like to be alone. What? That's so weird to me. It's very strange. Again, Tony persisted. He's going to crack this thing wide open. While he changed in the dressing room, Brian did coke and became much more talkative and loose. They got into the pool's warm water. A low fog was hanging around them. And Brian suddenly asked Tony if he wanted to see a neat trick. He explained what erotic asphyxiation was, and he wondered if Tony might want to try it with him. But Tony was scared, because this didn't seem like the first time Brian had asked someone that question. His mind flashed to his missing friend, but he agreed just to keep the peace. The last thing he wanted to do was upset this man that he thought was responsible for his friend's disappearance. Mm-hmm. Tony went first, choking Brian while he masturbated. Then they switched positions. Brian took the pool hose, laid it around Tony's neck, and began to tighten it. Only he didn't stop. He was pulling it tighter and tighter and tighter. And Tony started to fear that he was going to be strangled until he died. He just let his body go limp. And after a few moments of silence, Brian whispered Tony's name and he popped his eyes open and scared the shit out of Brian.
Oh, I just scared the hell out of me too.
And Brian was visibly surprised and shaken by this.
So he thought he was dead.
Yeah. And Tony confronted him. He said, "It's you, Brian. You're hurting people. I have to go to the police." And Brian told him that no one was going to believe a person like him. Like him.
What a piece of shit. Yeah. That makes me so mad.
It did stir up that fear in Tony. And he thought Brian was right. No one would believe him. So then his prerogative became, I need to get out of this house alive. He loosened it back up and suggested that they drink and talk at the fully stocked bar. And they drank until Brian eventually passed out on a couch. While he was sleeping, Tony snuck upstairs and saw the evidence that Brian Smart actually had a family. He was not the groundskeeper.
Oh, that was his house?
Yes. The next morning, he drove Tony.
That makes the mannequin thing so weird.
Yeah, the owner doesn't like to be alone. The next morning, he drove Tony back to downtown Indy. He told him he had a great time and he would love to see him again. Nope, that's going to be a hard no for me, friend.
That's
going to
be a no for me, dog.
Tony went straight to the police. He told them that there was a mansion in Hamilton County where he believed that the murderer, a man named Brian Smart, was staying. But it had been late and dark. They were under the influence. He hadn't seen the whole name of the farm. There were so many farms on that road he had gone down. The police acted like he was crazy. Mm-hmm. The FBI told him that he had been on drugs and he didn't know what he was talking about. Virgil, the PI, was the only person who listened.
Attaboy, Virgil.
But without more info, it was a literal horse farm in a countywide haystack. He told Tony, get a license plate number, a phone number, anything. Come back when you do. Come see me. And the thing was, Tony was still talking to Brian. Occasionally, only by payphone or cell. But Tony didn't actually see him again until 1995, the next year. And when he did reappear, it was at another bar. Tony cornered him, sent a friend out to get the license plate number from the car, while he kept Brian talking. Now, this will make more sense later, but we should note that this is Tony's official version of events. Brian did continue to contact him, but in later interviews, Tony actually admitted to continuing a romantic and sexual relationship with Brian. He said to the FBI that he only went to Fox Hollow that first night, but he did later admit that he was at the house several more times and he would meet with Brian whenever the opportunity arose because he fell for him and became involved. And because he was involved, it made him feel like he couldn't go to the police because they would assume that he was an accomplice in all of these murders. And honestly, he was right. That's exactly what would have happened. Regardless, though, had he not come forward even a year later with the license plate number, they would have never had their first big and only lead on who was committing these crimes. The license plate was tracked to a local businessman, Herb Baumeister. His address was listed at Fox Hollow Farm. Herb Baumeister, however you say it, was born on April 7th, 1947, in Indianapolis, Indiana. Herb was always a little off. He once put a dead crow on his teacher's desk. He talked about what it would be like to drink pee. He was irresponsible and quick to anger. All of these contributed to his lack of friends, and his behavior caused his dad, who was an anesthesiologist, to have a psychiatric test done on him for any mental illnesses he might have, and he had it done in secret when Herb was in his teens. He received a diagnosis of schizophrenia with the possibility of more than one personality.
Oof.
At that time, though, that was treated almost exclusively with electric shock therapy. So he didn't treat it at all.
Oh.
Nice, right? Your dad's a doctor, but not going to treat your schizophrenia. Herb made it through school, and he got into IU and went off to college.
Aw, I love IU.
What do you think he studied there?
I don't know. I'm going between, like, he was either, like, a mortician or...
You're close. It was anatomy.
Yep.
He dropped out after one semester in 1967, but he met his wife, Julie. She was a journalism teacher and recently graduated from Indiana University. A friend introduced the two. They were both part of the Young Republicans Club and both wanted to one day own their own business. They were married in 1971. Because his dad was a very respected anesthesiologist, he was able to help him get a job at the Indianapolis Star, writing copy. What's the store? No, the Indianapolis Star, the paper. He was writing copy. A coworker once recalled that Herb had offered to pick up all the guys so that they could drive to an IU game. But when he arrived, he was in a hearse and wearing a chauffeur's cap. He raced speeding the entire 2-hour drive with the lights on while people frantically pulled off of the road. And this could have been the reason that Herb's father committed him to a psych ward for 2 months.
We're going on a joyride, boys. Hold on.
Julie was patient. His wife, he left the hospital and he went back to being a doting husband.
He got shocked there.
Bet he did. He lost that job, but he secured a job at the BMV, and it was no secret that he was strange. Everyone called him Weird Herb.
Aww.
He would rant and rave about anything and everything. He once peed on his boss's desk, and he was inevitably fired after he peed on a letter that was addressed to Robert Orr, the governor at that time.
Oh, Jesus.
I know. During these years, Herb and the now stay-at-home mom, Julie, had 3 children between 1979 and 1984.
Yikes.
Yeah. But he was a very involved father. It was the biggest part of his life. After he was fired, he became a stay-at-home dad that worked odd jobs, and Julie went back to teaching. In 1985, while they were spending time at Herb's parents' lake house at Lake Wawasee,
oh, yeah.
Herb was arrested for pulling a hit and run while driving drunk. And a year after that, he was arrested for insurance fraud, but the case was dismissed. He kind of finally got his shit together in 1988. He and his wife borrowed $4,000 from his mom after his dad died, and they opened a thrift store called Save-A-Lot. And if you read about this case at all, and you're from Indiana, you'll see Save-A-Lot, and it's talking about this thrift store. It's not talking about the grocery store.
Okay, that was my first thought. I was like, yeah, whoa.
Me too, when I read it. And I read some Amazon reviews for books, and there were people that were like, he didn't own thrift stores, he owned groceries. And I was like, no, Save-A-Lot was a thrift store. Just so you know. Part of the proceeds from this thrift store went to the Indianapolis Children's Bureau, and the store flourished. It was clean and easy to shop. They did so well that they opened a second location only 2 years later in 1990. Because of this, they were able to purchase their stately Tudor home in Westfield, Indiana, on 18.5 acres of woods and country hills in 1991. The same year, the bodies stopped appearing on the side of I-70.
Hmm.
The bodies that were found on I-70, they were often nude or partly undressed. They were always men. They were strangled and laid haphazardly in rural areas or along the river that goes along I-70. In 1983, Michael Riley's body was found. 1985 was Eric Roediger. He was only 17. Mm-hmm. 1989, 26-year-old Stephen Elliott was found. 1990, 32-year-old Clay Boatman. 9 men were found in total, and some of them were transient and never identified. Even though the bodies stopped appearing, gay men in Indianapolis were still going missing. In 1993, 5 men disappeared.
Oh my God.
Michael Riley and Johnny Bayer in May, Jeffrey Jones and Richard Hamilton in July, Alan Livingston in August. 1994 brought the April disappearance of Stephen Hale, and then Alid Brosard and Roger Goodlett that summer. And the similarity between all of these missing people is that they're going missing April through August. The weather's nice. There are no disappearances that happen when it's gross out in Indiana. And there were people who suspected that this was the work of a serial killer that was targeting young men or men who just wouldn't be missed. But the police were unconvinced that it was all the work of one man. Because this is a lot of people.
Yeah, that is a lot of people.
Detective Mary Wilson, a missing persons special investigator at the IMPD, was the woman working many of these missing person cases. She was also the detective who received the license plate number from Tony Harris. This, combined with the tips from her friend, Virgil Vandegrift, convinced her that Herb Baumeister was Brian Smart, and it was the man that they wanted. So she wasted no time.
Atta girl.
Mary went to the Save-A-Lot store that Herb ran and asked the employee at the counter to speak to Mr. Baumeister. When Herb came out of the back, he was totally friendly. He shook her hand and he introduced himself, but she got straight to the point. She decided to just be up front. And his mood totally shifted when she asked how often he frequented gay bars in downtown Indianapolis. When presented with evidence that many eyewitnesses had seen him there on numerous occasions, and it was also where she had gotten his license number, Herb relented. At first, he was like, "No way, I've never been to a gay bar in my life. I'm a married man with 3 children." But he did admit that he had been going to the gay bars. His wife and his family didn't know. He had been married for 25 years at this point. He had 3 children, and knowing this could ruin that for him.
I think April through August, and I think that his family's at the lake.
1 second, and we'll continue talking about that. Detective Warren explained that she was investigating the disappearances of these men from those gay bars, and she believed that he was involved. If he wasn't, would he mind if they searched his property? He immediately told her that if she had any more questions, she could contact his lawyer. And after several back and forths with the law office, they told her that no, they could not search Fox Hollow Farm. So what do you do when the husband tells you no? You ask the wife.
Oh!
She went right behind his back to ask Julie. Unfortunately, Julie had already been coached by Herb what to say. He told her that he was being blackmailed by a disgruntled employee, that he was being accused of theft. But Detective Mary Wilson was honest. She told Julie that her husband was the suspect in the disappearances of several men in the Indianapolis area. And this stunned her. It stunned her because a few years prior, their son had been playing in their backyard at Fox Hollow Farm when he discovered a full skeleton. He had picked up the skull and was playing with it, using it to scare his sisters.
Oh.
And when Julie found out, she demanded to know where he found it. Her son led her to a spot in the woods near a mulch pile, and she was so scared because she saw an entire skeleton in her backyard.
I'd be like, "All right, now we have to move."
Yeah. The skull was still in the house. So when Herb got home that evening, she said, "Why the hell is there a skeleton in the backyard?" Herb was caught off guard, but he said, "That's just an old medical prop my dad had." And Herb was kind of a hoarder, so she didn't question it. She was like, "Oh, okay, looks pretty messed up. Why is it on the ground outside? Nope, no other questions. Just accepted it. Now, though, that she was being presented with this.
She's like, wait a second. I thought he was being blackmailed for like being a thief. What are you talking about?
Exactly. The color drained from her face, but she still denied them the ability to search the grounds. Mary gave Julie her card and insisted that she call her if she changed her mind. And Julie did call Mary once to scream at her and tell her that she was the reason her marriage was failing. Her husband had never even heard of Tony Harris. But 6 months went by and their business began to fail. Their marriage was worse than ever, though it was never good. In their 25 years of marriage, Julie told investigators that Julie and Herb had only been intimate 6 times in 25 years. That's not even once a year. Not even close.
It was literally like when they were trying to have babies.
Yeah, exactly. They had babies and that was it. She initiated divorce proceedings. Now realizing she really had no reason to be loyal to this person, she had her lawyer contact the detective, tell Mary about the skeleton her son had found, and she allowed them to search the grounds.
Nothing like a woman scorned. Atta girl.
Hell hath no fury.
Yeah, boss bitch alert.
Oof. Her husband, Herb, and her son were gone for the weekend at her mother-in-law's condo at the lake, and now would be the time to look. So the next day, Detective Mary Wilson, Detective Jeff Markham, and Captain Tom Anderson all headed to Fox Hollow Farm to meet Julie and her lawyer. The captain told Detective Wilson that her suspicions were bullshit. He was convinced that they were only going to find animal bones. But oh, how wrong the captain was. Because immediately, as soon as they began to kick around the grass, they found a charred long bone. What looked like pebbles and rocks from a distance turned out to be bone fragments and teeth scattered all over the yard that Julie and Herb's children were playing in.
Oh my God.
At one point, the lawyer looked at the ground where he was standing, bent over, and picked up a human tooth. It was everywhere. Detective Wilson delivered bags of bone fragments to a forensic anthropologist, and his quick response was, "They're human, they're recent, and they've been burned." During the next search of the grounds, they dropped an orange flag whenever they found something. And in a half hour, they dropped over 100 flags. It was a graveyard.
And their kids were just playing.
Yep. Neighbors started to come forward to tell police that they had found bones on their adjacent properties. They led investigators to an area that was covered in rib bones, vertebrae, and spine. And there was more when they started digging.
Oh my God. So this is just like, yeah. This isn't like you're not excavating at this point.
Yeah, this is a decade or more worth of tens of bodies. When the body count started, it hit about 7. It grew to 11 with the new location. But by the end of everything, they found an estimated 19 bodies.
Oh my God. I've never, and it's crazy because for anyone who's listening to this episode and you're not from Indiana, Westfield, Indiana is one of the most prestigious places to live around Indianapolis.
Like, it is very high end. It's high cost.
Houses, the median is like $500,000-$600,000. Like, yeah. That's just for like a small, like, to have.
It is a very nice area. And when you see the house that I'm going to post, you're going to be like, holy shit. The house is like nice as hell. It really was a mansion. Tony wasn't exaggerating.
It's insane because as soon as you said Westfield, I was like, oh my God.
Yes. It's an affluent neighborhood. You don't expect your neighbor to be a serial killer.
And it's hard because, you know, we do so many local cases and I've never heard of this case. And I have frequented this. I mean, I take I-70 every time I come see anyone back home. You drive it every time you come to us.
Yeah, like anytime I go to your house, I drive it. I drive it when I go to see my dad. It's like you'd go on it all the time. And I picture it, you know, you picture that drive. Can you imagine just seeing a body like haphazardly thrown on the side of the road?
I can go two blocks from my house and see I-70.
Yeah.
I drive it the opposite way into Dayton. I drive that every day to work. It gets, man. Well,
luckily, we haven't had this situation for a while. Or else I would say, you need to start taking the side roads. No more I-70 for you. So they're finding all these bones, right? 19 people. Where's Herb? The first day that the bones were revealed, Julie sent two detectives to pick up her son, who went with officers reluctantly. And it's a shame that they didn't take Weird Herb while they were there. I don't understand this part, really. I kind of tried to look in more into it, and I couldn't specifically find why they got...
I wonder if they were waiting for the forensics to come back.
I think they were probably just building evidence. They didn't. Yeah. It was circumstantial at that point still. But as soon as his son left, he got in his Buick and started driving north. They only learned that because 5 days after the investigation started, Herb's brother called investigators to report that before he had known what was happening, Herb had called his brother and asked him to wire money. He said that he was in Michigan on a business trip. But by that time, Baumeister had already crossed into Canada. Shortly after he crossed the border, he pulled to the side of the road to take a nap. And a Mountie approached his car and told them that it wasn't safe for him to sleep there and he needed to go. The Mountie noted that there were a very large amount of video cassette tapes in the back seat, insinuating that Herb Baumeister had filmed his murders. But on July 3rd, 1996, Herb Baumeister pulled into Pinery Park in Ontario, Canada, and according to his suicide note, he ate a peanut butter sandwich and went to sleep, and the videotapes were gone when his body was found. You hate to see it. Virgil Vandergriff, the PI, had made the connection to the I-70 bodies and the Fox Hollow Farm bodies. He informed the prosecution in Ohio Tony Harris's story, and they agreed that the similarities were undeniable because those bodies were found on separate sides of the state, cross state lines.
Mm-hmm.
The last I-70 murder happened right before Herb Baumeister moved to his farm. Julie eventually told police that Herb had traveled that road more than 100 times during those years for just random business reasons. New witnesses started coming forward to say that Herb looked like the man that they believed to be the strangler. One man noted that this was the man that had driven he and his friend home from the bar that night. His friend was one of the missing persons. It was Michael Riley.
Oh.
And it was never able to be confirmed that Baumeister was the I-70 strangler, but it's largely assumed that he was. Vandergriff, he said he didn't have finances to tie up all of the loose ends in this case, but he did note something of interest. Herb's older brother lived in Texas, not the one that sent him money. And around the time that the I-70 murders were happening, he was found strangled in his hot tub. Did he murder his brother? Maybe.
I think so. Was he down there at the time?
He said he didn't have the money to figure out if he was or not. Didn't have the, and Herb was gone by that point when he had realized it. So no idea. But how did Julie
do with the,
huh?
What did they do with the house?
So the house was sold, but I want to talk about Julie really quick because there's tens of bodies being murdered at your house and you're not finding any evidence, right? And the fact was that Julie and Herb's marriage wasn't great. And as soon as the weather would get nice, she would take the kids to her mother-in-law's and they would stay at the lake house pretty much until the end of summer.
Which, again, if you're familiar, if you're not from Indiana, if you are close to a lake town, I mean, we do it. We go to the lakes often. That is a thing.
It's a Midwest thing.
It's weather's nice. Let's go swim in this lake.
Yeah. Herb never went. He never went with them. And that's what... All of his people disappeared during that time because no one was home.
As soon as you said Wawasee, and then you said they only happened between April and August. That's boating season. That's lake life season.
Yeah, they were there. That's what they were doing. the kids and Julie.
I feel like it would smell.
So he would burn the bodies and put them in mulch, and he would burn them under trash. Mm. And he would, then animals would come because it was wooded, and they would like drag the pieces apart. So they were scattered everywhere. They also found in the place where the ribs and the vertebrae and the spines were, they found cans of Herb's favorite beer everywhere. They were all just like laying around all the bones. Now I want to talk about the accomplice theory. This is a lot of murders, right? For one dude. How are you dragging dead bodies? He's not a big guy. He was doing a lot of labor for someone who doesn't look like he can do a lot of labor. Tony was interviewed several years later, and he believed that Herb had an accomplice. And this theory was echoed, because how does one person murder 20 plus people and not get caught in a small town? And some people have suggested that Larry Eiler was his accomplice. And if you don't know, he is another, Larry was another Indiana serial killer who killed boys. Tony told a pretty compelling story. When he pulled into the driveway of Fox Hollow Farm that night, Herb made it a point to shine his lights in the attached apartment window by the garage. And then they just sat in the car for a little bit with the lights shining in the window. And for some reason, Herb went nuts. He started yelling and punching and slamming on the steering wheel like he went into a blind rage. And this was totally different from his personality that he had had all the evening, which was pretty meek. Tony even said he was initially aggressive with Brian to determine if he could, you know, take him if he needed to. And he decided to go with him because he was so mild-mannered. But now here he was yelling, "You can't count on anybody anymore," for no reason. Tony said in an interview that he thought Herb wanted to try and kill him several times that night. The first time was when Brian, or Herb, tried to lead Tony into a changing room to do cocaine. He pulled a handgun on him, told Tony he called it Dirty Harry, but Tony didn't go into the room with him. He felt like something was holding him back and preventing him from going in. And that ended up being the same gun that Herb shot himself with. But for the entire night, stuff like that kept happening. He asked if he needed to go to the bathroom. "Do you need to go in the changing room? You want to take a shower?" Just anywhere that he thought Tony would be vulnerable. So Tony actually gave Herb some pretty gnarly weed he had because he had been awake for days on coke. And that was why Herb had passed out. He explored the house because he was going to rob him. He was trying to find something of value that he could sell. He noted that he was a very different person then, which, fair, we all are. But years later, when the house had been sold, it was sold to a couple named Rob and Vicky. He went into the changing room, and the moment that Tony stepped inside, all of the lockers opened and shut at the same time, followed by a very loud boom. And the thing that I think unsettled me most from the interview with Tony was that he believed that after he failed to kill him, he began to groom him. He talked about how Herb didn't always use the pool hose. He showed him how to strangle with ties that couldn't be undone and with leather belts. Tony thought that whatever accomplice Herb had, he wanted to be rid of, because he wanted it to do it with him instead. And Herb let Tony choke him too. Like, they were doing it back and forth to each other. He wanted Tony to prove that Herb had taught him something, so he would make him recite a script. Sometimes Herb would play dead and then get up and chastise Tony for almost actually killing him. Tony doesn't know how many times he went back to Fox Hollow Farm, but once while his wife and kids were out of town, he recalled Herb choking him in the pool. And he said it was very romantic. Herb never attacked him. He only told the FBI that so that they would investigate him because, in his own words to Herb's spirit while he was at Fox Hollow Farm doing this interview, "If you're listening to me, you know why I said those things I said. I had to stop it. The deaths had to stop." So, sounds kind of sketch, right?
Like, gives maybe me the heebs.
I know. The interview I read with him, the guy who did it said that Tony seemed really genuine, so he doesn't believe that he was involved, but I think he knew more than he let on.
Yeah.
The skeptic in me is like,
Yeah, I know. Me too. When I was reading it, I was like, And the interview actually said at one point, wow, Tony sure told you a lot about these murders, like called him out. And that's when he told him that he thought he was trying to groom him. And if you are going to continue to look up this, there are two I-70 serial killers. There's Herb, the I-70 strangler, and there's also the I-70 killer. And Herb murdered gay men, but the killer murdered petite brunette women between 1992 and 1994, and he was never captured. They never found out who did that one. That's still a cold case.
That's why I thickened up. I'm not considered a petite brunette anymore.
That's why I thickened up. Put some cornstarch on me. I'm thick.
Man.
I'm not fully done yet even. So let's talk about the Amityville link here and talk about how haunted Fox Hollow Farm is.
Oh, God. Look, I'm going to be honest.
Can you handle it?
I'm doing this for the listeners. I don't do haunted. Like, I can read the most brutal murders and go to sleep like a baby.
This is going to mess you up then.
But the haunted stuff, okay, just give it to me.
Okay, so Julie sold the house, but it did not sell for a very long time. It was listed at $2.8 million. And a couple named Rob and Vicky Graves bought it in 2009 for a steal. They bought it for like $900,000.
Oh, dang.
Yeah. It's a lot. I mean, that's still a lot of money, but
yeah, it's more than I can spend on the house.
But it's not $2.8 million.
Pocket change.
It's a good deal. After they bought it, the first instance happened when Vicky saw a man in a red shirt standing in the woods. She thought it was a trespasser, and when she went to confront him, the man vanished in front of her eyes. It happened twice before she told her husband about it, who had also seen the man in the red shirt. They talk about how their vacuum cleaner cord, when they're vacuuming, every single time is tugged completely out of the wall. Even though they have enough cord, they can plug it back in, it will continue to be pulled out.
Wait, they live there still?
Yes. Yeah. There's more. There's that apartment, right? The one he was shining his headlights into. And they rented it out to one of Rob's coworkers who was looking for a place to live. And
the
one
audacity.
Night.
So shitty of them to do.
He was excited about the idea that it was haunted, you know, what a dummy. His name was Joe. And one night Joe heard a knock at the door. And it just kept getting louder. He was in the kitchen eating and it's like, I'm coming, I'm coming. But when he got to the door, no one was there. So he started deadbolting it. And one night the deadbolt tore itself open. He also saw the man in the red shirt and others. A ton of psychics have visited this place. They have all described what they believe is a portal in the apartment's bathroom and in the swimming pool. And this couple, they're not like super crunchy spiritualists. Vicky's a scientist. They did not believe in this stuff, which is why they bought it in the first place. But one psychic really changed their minds. He was able to tell them things about themselves and people that they knew that there was no way they could have known. He could have known. And he explained to them that the souls that are trapped there are frustrated. They're frustrated with the amount of people that are coming there to try to talk to them. They're frustrated that they can't get out. And initially, that area was colonized and the Native Americans that lived there were murdered. So on top of that, Herb's actions really just fueled everything and just like piled on all this negative spiritual energy. So Rob and Vicky have since explained that they're just trying to fill the house with as much positivity to override it and make it better. And the hauntings have slowed down. Like the longer they live there, the fewer they haven't seen the man in the red shirt in a very long time. Rob specifically believes that Baumeister's ghost still is there, though he thinks he's probably just like dropping in. The psychic said that it wasn't Herb. It was like a negative spiritual entity that liked to pretend he was Herb. But Rob just says, as long as it keeps to himself and doesn't mess with his family, like, you don't mess with my family, I won't mess with you, kind of a thing.
Do they have kids?
Yeah, they have two sons. And one of the sons lives in that apartment now. And he said that it's been fine since he's lived there. Because they've lived there for, I mean, 2009. I don't love to think that that was like 15 years ago, but it wasn't 15, but like 11, 12.
I wonder if the sons don't get messed with because the victims were men.
So apparently they are more prone to mess with women in specific rooms, like in Herb's bathroom. Vicky, the wife, said that she does not like being in there. She feels unwelcome. She said that she can't even go in the changing room in the pool area. Like, she feels sick if she goes in there. And she tried to, like, overcome her fear. She was like, this is silly. I'm going to go in there and go to the bathroom. Because this changing room is like a shower bathroom kind of situation with lockers. And she said the entire time she was in there, she felt like someone was just staring at her and watching her. It's been on a couple of different paranormal TV shows. And they have, like, filmed, like, guttural growls and clips and angry stuff. They've seen all kinds of stuff on there. It's crazy.
I wonder if he had an accomplice that he murdered.
So Tony thinks that, yes, he did have an accomplice, and he calls him Sounds Like Joe, but he actually calls him SLJ. And he said that he was the main guy that was doing this, and he forced Herb to do everything. So Sounds Like Joe, he believed that Sounds Like Joe actually killed Herb in Ontario and took the tapes. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I know, right? Like, I see your face. I see what you're thinking. And there's just no way to tell. But he believes that it was him. And he thinks that Sounds Like Joe died around 10 years ago, separately from this whole situation.
I don't trust Tony.
You know, he seems very eccentric. I wish I knew his real name so I could look more into him and what he says, but I can't. Because it's really, normally I can like sneak around. Like, the books that I read didn't list the real names of like Detective Wilson or a couple of them, and I still found their names. But, oh, the anthropologist, I found his name. I just didn't include it.
And this is because I have watched too much TV. Like, I think of the man in the red shirt is like, maybe the accomplice was like the original, like, you know, similar to what Tony said. Like, maybe it was like, and like, this is, again, everything I've ever learned from.
This is all speculative.
This is speculation from every TV show I've ever watched, because this thing is insane. But I think of like, he was the original, and maybe he is the one that murdered most of these boys, men. And he's pissed that, you know, Weird Herb is getting the
credit. Ooh, that's a nice theory there, that like the spirit is angry with them. Joe said that one time he was in the swimming pool and he felt hands around his neck. And that really freaked me out when I read that. Yeah, I know. I see your face is just like, mm-mm. Nope, mm-mm. Don't like that. It's wild. I just think it's crazy when people who don't believe in that kind of stuff feel like they do, like their minds are changed.
And I have my out, like, I know that this type of stuff exists. I told you guys my experience with what I believe was a paranormal situation. And the type of brain that I have that just fixates, that it just stresses me out. I would never be able to live in a house that I like know is haunted. I literally told my husband, so we're in the house buying process right now. I know we're idiots. It's the worst market ever to do this, but like, you know, whatever. We're looking at one of the houses was built in 1920. And I said, I'm going to ask if it's haunted. And he's like, they're not going to tell you. I'm like, no, they have to. Like, if, you know, that's, they have to disclose if they know that it's haunted. So if it is haunted, we could get the fuck out of there.
Or if something like sketch has ever happened in there, they do have to tell.
Yeah. Them. Has anyone ever been murdered in here? Is this Native American ground?
When we moved into our house, it was it's an old house. It was built in 1901.
If you ever want me to spend the night at your house and you're about to say something that's haunted, I would stop.
No, it's... So when we first moved in, lots of very scary things happened. Lights would come on randomly. We heard like voices over the baby monitor that we thought sounded like an old, like two men talking over an old timey radio. And Jordan was like, probably just some CB radio. I was like, yeah, that's fair. Okay. But one time I was sitting in our front room, which is has a bay window in it. And I was sitting there reading and the light went off in the room. Like I was just sitting there and the light went completely off. And I was like, okay, I'm leaving. I'm going out of here now. And when, as soon as I walked out of the room, the light came back on. And I was like, okay. But my husband's family has lived in this house literally for 70 years. Like one family member moves out and the next one moves in. One family member. So whoever it is or whatever it is that's in our house, like they're related to us. And Jordan, at a certain point after we moved in, we had to legit go around the house and be like, we're family. We live here. It's cool if you stay, but you got to quit messing with the lights. It's not fun anymore. And it has pretty much stopped. I don't really see it. I haven't seen anything in like years now.
You are so St. Karen, when they first moved to Louisiana, they also moved to a family house that had been in the family for years and years and years. And it was the house that her husband grew up in. And it was haunted, like legitimately haunted. And her husband decided as like a teenage kid that he was going to mess with this spirit. And I don't know the specifics because like I said, I like to tune out stuff like that because we've stayed at that house before. Like it's not the house they live in now, but like when they like, you know, 10 years ago or whatever. And it was a blue head or blue something like that.
Like an orb.
That appeared that it was on fire and it was not nice. And he was pissed that her husband kept messing with him.
Yeah, that's not cool. Yeah. Don't mess with him. I was just like, guys, I understand that like we're in your house. You haven't had people up here in a long time because his grandma lived in the house, but she only lived in the bottom half of it and only in like a couple of rooms, pretty much. Just like the middle room, the kitchen, the bathroom, and like the side room, which you guys don't know what that, you don't know what that means, but
I know what that means.
You know what it means. Yeah. She just lived downstairs. So when we moved in, the upstairs had barely been opened in 30, 40 years. So we were like, hey guys, we're moving up. We're moving up here.
Like, surprise. We're here too.
Surprise, Shawty. Oof. Yeah, it was.
There's
that room that happened in, the room that where the light went off and I walked out, that room was closed off. No one ever used it. And I had opened it and cleaned everything out. I took out the carpet. I completely changed it. And that was when that happened.
They were pissed.
They were like, hey, I did not. I decorated this room. I'm like, yeah, that's why I'm changing it.
I'm just like hypersensitive with this stuff. Like it's,
maybe you have like high, like spiritual frequencies where it affects you more because you're more attuned to it.
It just stresses me out real bad. Like it's, and I think like if I'm having good ADHD days, a good one, where if I'm like not fixating, I'm like, oh, okay, yeah. But if it's a day where I'm like, oh shit, I'm going to think about this until next Tuesday. Luckily, we've been having some good days, but that's just so. And I do not understand buying a house that you know is haunted. I don't care if they're like, hey,
they didn't believe in it before they moved in. You know, they were just like, this house is incredible. We're getting a great deal on it.
I would instantly think, even if I didn't believe in it, I would know that people were murdered there.
Yeah, that's fair.
Like, it's like, all right, because instantly we have a house, like, it's funny because like the house that is across the street from me, they tried to sell it like all summer, and literally houses in the town that I live in, they sell within hours of being posted. And I'm really frustrated by that. But this house sat so long that when we are finally like, hey, let's shoot our shot. Let's try and buy a house. Let's see what we got. because the market is not going to get better. It's just going to get crazier. So let's just see what we can. And my husband was like, let's look at that house. I'm like, it's sat. Like, it has been for sale for 6 months. They've had three people come in to do inspections. And like, it just keeps going back on the market. I said, something's wrong with it, or someone was murdered there. And I want no part of that. Like, what kind of vibes?
Was someone murdered there? Did you do a Google about it?
No, nothing. I already looked. But I'm assuming it's just got like a lot. They wanted way, but in this town, like we just looked at a free, just yesterday, guys, send some vibes, because we put an offer in on a house that was like, what, $6,000 or $7,000 over the asking price. Someone came in for like $25,000 more than what we offered and bought it cash. And it was not worth that. Like, it's,
you know,
a nice.
I said, who has that much money just in cash? Like, who has $250,000
in cash?
And, like,
if you're a listener and you have it, like, holler at your girl, because I think
I need
cash.
How'd you get it? What
bank
did
you rob? But, God, like, knowing – and honestly, I feel like out of respect for the victims, I would burn that shit to the ground.
Yeah. That is also a fair point. Like,
I
like what they're doing. I like their theory of – like bringing positive energy and mm-hmm. helping like some of them move on. And one of the psychics legitimately walked there because spirits had directed him there, he said. And he said that he was supposed to let Rob know, who happened to be in the front of the house doing like yard work at the time, because it has a lock on the driveway. Normally it's all locked up. But he said that they had led him there to let him know that they were frustrated with all the people that were coming in and trying to talk to them. And that was the one who told him all the weird stuff about that had never happened. Like his one of the son's girlfriends that they had only met one time was at the house. And when he saw her, he said, your grandma says to tell you that she misses watching the goldfinches with you. And like, that's what her and her grandma used to do together, was watch goldfinches on the back porch. But she like Rob and Vicky barely knew that girl. Why would that guy know her, you know?
It's just,
I think it's very cool.
Yeah, I don't, but like, I think it would be different for me if it were like one or two murders, but this is like, you know, upwards of 20. And it's just when you add on the extra bad juju of like it being like a Native American area first.
That was colonized. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's real sad. And honestly, I feel horrible for his family. Yeah. Weird Herb's.
Weird Herb's family. Yes.
But as soon as I'm swimming in a pool that I would never swim in a pool that I knew people had been strangled in. And when I felt those hands around my neck, I would have burnt the house down and been like, whoop, I don't know what happened. Must have been all the spirits here. You know, we've talked about it. You guys have seen it on TV. They're here and they burnt the house down.
So weird.
What's unfortunate is they can't even pull like an Amityville Horror where like he was possessed. That's why he did it, because he was a piece of shit before they moved into that house.
Well, that's what they asked the psychics. Was her possessed by like a demonic entity? And everyone has been like, no, he was not possessed by a demonic entity. There's no demons here. There is a negative entity here, but it's not.
If I got picked up by a creepy old white man and
he wasn't that old, he was in his 30s when this started.
Oh, well, I digress. Well, regardless, if I was murdered at this house that I pulled up to with creepy mannequins all over the pool, I would be a negative entity too.
I would also vanish into thin air. Poof.
I'd splash.
There they go.
But yeah, it's unfortunate, like for the victims.
That part is weird.
It's really unfortunate for the victims.
Lonely.
Yeah. What the fuck? I saved it for that. Like, what?
Tony said that he always referred to himself in third person, which makes me think of that like schizophrenic personality. Was he disassociating into a different personality when he was murdering? And then
makes me wonder if there was anyone in that apartment.
Ooh, yeah, that's true too. And Tony said that he felt like Brian, quote unquote, and Herb were two different people, because he started a romantic relationship with Brian And he was never abusive or mean. He was very meek and kind and calm, but he also had this very like scary, even evil side, you know?
And the sad part, like, obviously I am not sticking up for Weird Herb at all because there's no excuse for what he has done, but
no.
Midwest Indiana for homosexuals, especially in that time.
It's better, but it's not great.
No. And it's the level that, like, the step someone would go to hide who they truly are, like, that seems right on par with Midwest Indiana, mm-hmm. which is very unfortunate.
And sad. It's sad that all of these
yeah.
men disappeared.
Like, maybe he was, like, embarrassed that he was gay. So he had this, like, Brian persona.
I absolutely think that that's what happened. And that he tried to cover it up with getting married or whatever he did so mm-hmm. that he could hide it. And it just.
And if you're schizophrenic and, you know, if you truly do disassociate and you have this, like, the real me is, like, Brian. Like, that's me. That's, you know, I'm loving. Like, I love Tony.
Just a nice gay guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it's like you have that Herb side where it's, I'm a Midwest white Republican. This isn't acceptable. I can't do this.
Yeah. On top of, yeah.
Indiana's the land of Mike Pence.
But there is a gay guy named Hot Mike Pence, and he looks like Mike Pence, and he goes around dressed in just hot pants. And
I love it.
He's very funny. I love that. Man. It's cute.
I want to dive into the psychology of this because I do think it was, schizophrenia is no joke. Like, it's a punchline for a lot of things, but like slipping into like these psychoses and, you know, when you truly disassociate, not just like it's a scary thing. And it's, thank God the world of mental health has come like as far as it has. And even like them microdosing like LSD and shrooms to be like, hey, this can fix that part of your brain, you know, where the chemicals are imbalanced. But it's scary and it's, man, but there's still no excuse to murder 20 people. What do the investigators think?
About which part?
The accomplice. Do they agree?
I think that it's one of those. So there was a guy who wrote for a gay newspaper in Indy, and he said that he believes that it wasn't just Herb. He believes that because it was an election year, they said it was just Herb and they tied a pretty bow on it and just went from there.
Sometimes that's easier for them.
Yeah, they just ignored it. And I don't disagree with that.
I think it makes sense that there's someone else in some capacity.
Yeah, and I'm not saying it's Tony. I don't necessarily believe that specifically, but
I don't think
it was him initially.
No, and I'm not saying that Tony did it. I'm just saying Tony knows more than what
Tony's letting on. Yeah.
Because that's just, yikes. That's a lot. It makes sense that he killed himself, though. I would expect that from him because it'd be easier for him to kill himself than to face
everything.
Yeah.
There's a video of him on the news that I'm going to post, actually. There's a video of him and he's ranting to the news because the line sprayer for the roads, they sprayed over a dead raccoon that was on the side of the road. So the yellow line just went over it, over the face. And he's super mad about it. He's like, you know, this raccoon deserved better than that. But he's standing in front of his property where
they're
the bones of all of the people he murdered are. Just
the audacity.
That's where I really see that like multiple personality thing coming in. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's this person who can feel so like he needs to vindicate this raccoon.
But also in regards to the spray painted raccoon, it's the most Indiana thing you've said all day.
Right. Like I'm not getting out of the truck to move that. I'm just going to spray right over it.
Well, guys, thank you for that. I'm sure I was looking at the clock as we were doing it and it's like late and I'm like, I just have to take enough melatonin where I sleep through 3 a.m. because if I wake up at 3 a.m., I'm going to die.
I'm going to have a heart attack. not the witching hour.
Well,
damn. I'm good. That's all I got.
We do Friday for our patrons. I thought in my head how to say that like five times before I actually said it. we're doing a live this Friday.
And it's just going to be us talking about nothing. So if you're interested in what we talk about when we're not talking about true crime,
if you want to talk with us, let us know. Time is to be determined. We'll kind of figure out what kind of day our children are going to have.
It'll either be 9 to 10 or 10 to 11. 9:30 to 10:30.
It really depends on if my daughter has an early nap or not, or if she naps at all, you know. Daylight savings time. All right, guys.
Daylight savings is way over.
No, but it's still like it stays daylight so long.
Oh, yeah. Long. I get you. Yes. It's still like 9 o'clock and the sun's 10 up.
Yeah, it's like. Go.
I made the mistake of telling the six-year-old that she could go to bed when the sun set. So every day she wakes up and asks Alexa, what time is the sun setting? And then that's her bedtime for the night.
All right, guys. That's it. Thank you so much for listening to Gruesome, Horrific, True Crime.
We love you, beautiful strangers. And if you love us too, and you'd like us to keep putting out ad-free content, here are some of the ways that you can help support Gruesome.
You can leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. This helps other true crime connoisseurs find us, and you get a I knew them before they were famous moment.
Follow Gruesome Podcast on Instagram and talk to us on our posts. Engage with us. We love to hear from you there.
If you'd like to send a donation, we have a Patreon. Sign up to join our True Crime Sticker of the Month Club and to gain access to exclusive Patreon perks.
If a one-time donation is more your thing, you can find our Venmo at Gruesome Podcast and our PayPal using our email gruesomepodcast@gmail.com.
Speaking of which, we love hearing from you. It seriously makes our whole life. So send us questions, comments, suggestions, or just ask our opinion on whether or not that person you met on Tinder is a serial killer or not.
Tune in next week and don't forget, lock your windows, lock your doors, and on Wednesdays,
we're gruesome.
Bye.
Bye.